If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It's February 5th, 2025. It's 2:36 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and you found the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
What's up? It's Brandon Pope at WCIU.
Marge Halperin, award-winning journalist turned Democratic analyst and activist in the community, doing what I can to challenge authority.
This is Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of IronLight, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can buy my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
This is Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine Substack newsletter.
The Wall Street Journal made headlines this week with a headline which described the Donald Trump trade war with Mexico and Canada as the dumbest trade war in history. It's been a busy week, so let's play attraction distraction again. Are these things real enough to warrant our concern, or just part of the storm? The president says DEI led to the plane crash in Washington. All of this in the last 7 days. Transgender athletes will no longer compete as women. Gaza could be a beautiful resort once we remove all the Gazans. Elon Musk and a crack team of undergrads now have access to the Treasury Department. There will be investigations of the FBI agents who investigated the president, and U.S. aid is no more. And that's not even counting the Gabbard RFK Jr. hearings. Guys, for me, the most shocking thing of the week was the president assigning blame for the plane helicopter crash on Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Pete Buttigieg. He brought their names up right away. The most ridiculous thing in the last 7 days was that rhetoric about Gaza. And maybe the most impactful, maybe the freezing of U.S. aid. But Marge Halperin might disagree with that, having read her op-ed in the Tribune today. What's most important to you in the last 7 days? What most merits our attention, Marge?
I think it's the takeover of the federal government's computer system. It's the most massive data breach in the history of this country to have unscreened, uncredentialed people hook their own laptops or hard drives up to the national database that contains our social security numbers, our addresses, banking information, all the information that is needed to, for example, take out credit in your name if someone chooses, if there's a leak, which we have no idea how secured that process was. And the goal of it is just as bad as the actual breach, because they're trying to a massive layoff, regardless of what people's function is. I mean, already I read they had to hire somebody back because they needed them to process people's final HR paperwork, and they fired in one department somebody who does that. I mean, there's no sense of who these people are and what they do. The institutional knowledge that civil service employees provide to make our government run smoothly is being sliced without any regard. One experienced person is just as valued as a new, inexperienced hire. Civil service is a legal construct for a reason. And the reason is that originally we didn't have it. And so, in fact, in the 1800s, people's terms of employment in the federal government was only 4 years to match the presidential term, so that presidents could, on a wholesale basis, fill the government with loyalists as opposed to professionalists. And what happened? Corruption. Just what you would think would happen. Loyalty to the president instead of the Constitution is not what we want in terms of a criteria for our federal government. And that undermines every single aspect of the institutions that make up and protections that make up our federal government.
Are you consoled at all that we've been told that Elon Musk's team has been granted read-only status? They can't change or do anything?
They didn't give us any proof, and I have no reason to believe that, because they're slicing grants. They're laying off people. They can't do that if they don't have actual access. It's not clear who is making the decisions or executing them. Well, so they can tell us read only. They've given us no evidence that that's true.
How about you, Austin?
Just a further proof that Trump, more than any other president, operates in the attention economy. In that sense, the medium is the message. The message is attention. And the point of the attention, and I thought Ezra Klein put this well in the New York Times, is to project strength. And I think people need to be more skeptical than ever of how news is framed, especially by people we agree with, because they are also operating in an attention economy. And we also need to be aware that two or more things can be true in every story. And I think Doge is a good example of all of those things wrapped into one. So Ron Wyden, the Democratic senator, posted on Blue Sky that Doge had, quote, full access to the Treasury. That made a lot of people believe that Elon Musk is sitting there in a spreadsheet pressing the delete button and then stuff disappears. Now, as you mentioned, John, the Treasury sent a letter to Congress saying they have read-only access, and it's the same access that an auditor would have, for example. And it follows the same process of an auditor. And further, that the person leading that effort is this guy, Tom Krause. And Tom Krause is the head of the parent company of Citrix. Citrix is used by like 100 million people to remote access software. So it's like crazy tech wonk stuff that like a gajillion people use. Here's several things that are true about this story in my mind. One, putting people familiar with really large complex systems into government to look at our large complex systems is a good thing. We should encourage it, and there should be bipartisan agreement that we should have people who have done really difficult things, even if it's outside the public sector, that we need their talent, because that makes government more efficient and work better for everybody. Also, if people are stealing information from the government and giving it to private entities, that's against the law, and that's a huge problem. I have not seen proof of that yet, that this is being stolen or being used in a bad way or something by a private company. These people, as government employees, they're subject to all kind of the same restrictions that you would have. That we have to be wary of that, for sure. And then finally, and this is the point about like projecting strength, and the medium is the message, Musk will tweet and talk as if he is actually doing this. So he'll tweet something that says like deleted or gone or this is evil, right? And so for the average person, you're seeing, okay, Musk has power now and it's extraordinary. And he's projecting that by grabbing attention, saying, you know, deleted, deleted, deleted. I don't think that that's actually the full story. And I think it's in their interest for us to assume that they have all of that authority all the time. And I don't know if they necessarily do.
It's just so much. It's too much. It's just a constant spiral. And Austin's right. It's intentional. The idea is to get us to get so used to the chaos that casual news consumers and those who just don't want to consume news disengage and treat it as normal. And we're already seeing some of that happen because people are just beat down with the negativity. When you mentioned the DEI and Trump plane blame thing, I didn't realize that was all in this past week. It feels like we've lived like 3 months already. But that by far was the most shocking moment. I shouldn't say shocking. I'm not shocked by anything that he says. But the most stunning moment I've ever seen happen in American government during my lifetime. I've never seen something so blatantly dog whistle, so blatantly, I'm just going to say racist, coming from the highest office. You have people defending it and saying, well, you know, there's no proof he was talking about black people. We know who he was talking about. It's coded language. To blame any issue and the world's ills and America's problems on a diverse and equitable workforce without even knowing how DEI programs work is just completely backwards. And to have all that happen when we're supposed to be thinking about coming off of Dr. Martin Luther King Day, you know, a man who fought for equity, who fought for racial equity, who fought for cultural equity, religious equity. To have that come on the heels of Black History Month, where we celebrate the contributions of Black Americans and what they've done to help progress this country, it's just a slap in the face of so many people. And to have someone who's supposed to be a uniter in a moment of great tragedy, where people literally lost their loved ones,
to blame it on the other and point fingers right away without any evidence at all. It was just a sad moment for this country and raging. A dark time for a lot of people. People are really scared right now because of the words coming from the very top of the country.
That was kind of the lead in your Picayune Sentinel, wasn't it, Eric?
Yeah, on Tuesday I wrote, the headline was Plain Racist, P-L-A-N-E, racist. And I had given Trump the benefit of the doubt in some ways about some of the things that he'd said, like, well, he objected to Barack Obama. He said Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, it sounds racist, but maybe, you know, I mean, I just kept. But this, I totally agree with Brandon. It's like, essentially, when you blame DEI for a crash the day after, I mean, it happened on Thursday night and Friday morning, I think was the timeline. I mean, it's in the hours after this crash. We don't know whether the person in the control tower was at fault, whether the pilot of the jet was at fault, whether the Black Hawk was at fault. We didn't know that yet. And to suggest that somebody responsible was probably not a white man, and that's the only way to read this, right, is that white men weren't in charge, I think, because otherwise this crash wouldn't have happened. I don't know any other way. That's not even really a dog whistle. That's just racist. I mean, it's like, I don't know how else to put it. And I was similarly shocked at what he said. And then J.D. Vance tried to clean it up by saying, oh, well, what he meant to say was that DEI practices had made it harder for them to hire air traffic controllers, which is just not the case. That's not how DEI works. DEI works about broadening the scope of who you're looking at for positions. It's not narrowing it. It doesn't make it harder to hire people. It makes it more, if you're not trying to diversify your workforce, you're not interviewing enough of the right candidates. And it was awful. And that said, one of the thing that troubles me the most about this last week, first of all, absolutely true that they were just flooding the zone with stuff so that radio talk show hosts like John wake up every morning and say, I can fill my show. I don't have.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll comment on that in a minute, but go ahead.
The thing that actually I think is the most ominous, and maybe not, I can argue any of these things are the most ominous, but the fact that they're going after people in the Justice Department and in the FBI who participated in the investigation in January 6th, that they are going to, apparently, you're just going to fire FBI agents and career prosecutors who were part of the January 6th prosecutions and investigations, which essentially tells people in law enforcement everywhere that if you investigate somebody important, if you investigate something that's politically charged, you can lose your job, even if you do your job correctly. And I don't think there's any implication anywhere that anybody broke the law. The suggestion that if you investigate somebody for who's involved in a political scandal, that you could lose your job, that's just got an incredibly chilling effect on the justice system. And so that may be the most consequential thing that is happening right now.
And, you know, everybody sort of scrubs up for these hearings, Gabbard and RFK Jr. Rather than present the worst version of themselves, they presented the cleanest, new, scrubbed-up version of themselves. And even in the case that you just referred to, Eric, somebody in the Justice Department said something like, make no mistake about it, anybody who did their job as directed in the FBI has nothing to worry about. They're looking for rogue players. They're looking for ideologues who had an agenda against the president. And they're going to get those people. But people who did their job in the FBI have nothing to fear, which sounds nothing like what we have heard.
And they promised no enemies list when clearly General Milley's on the enemy list.
Hesh Patel had an enemies list. He put it in his book.
We've seen it.
He doesn't have one. I mean, they'll say anything in those hearings to get through them, and it looks like they are all going to get through
it. What I'm describing, though, with the FBI actually happened today. It wasn't a Hesh Patel's book, but rather once they strike the fear in you, it's the rhetoric sometimes. It's the attraction versus distraction. On the one hand, they'll say something, and then on the other hand, they say something that sort of patches it up. It's very confusing. So, if I may, as a radio talk show host, not only do you have a laundry list of things, you got to figure out what's the most important, what's the most relevant, what's the most entertaining, but also what's the fatigue point for people? This was Brandon's point, right? It's like if everybody agrees with me and I just keep talking about how awful or scary things are, I don't know that that's good or helpful radio. And some people would tend to disagree with it anyway. They like the steamroller that Trump is. So where people go, boy, John, you've got a lot to talk about. Personally, I don't think my job has ever been more difficult.
You're in an odd position, John, too, because you obviously want to reflect the news that people are talking about, and failure to engage in it is like, well, then other people get to define what it is, and you know, you might not be able to say what you want about it. I will say for maybe this is on the entertainment front, but for all the rightful criticism of social media, one of the best posts on X I've ever seen was on this issue of the identifying the 5,000 or so FBI employees engaged in the January 6th investigations, and someone replied back saying, as someone who as one of the J6ers, they said, which is the craziest preface to like a thing I've ever heard.
I'm in. Yeah,
as one of the J6ers, yeah. I thought the FBI agent who I dealt with operated very professionally and was, you know, really, you know, courteous and fair. And she seemed to know that, you know, this was like on the lower end of things that she should be worried about. It was so insane. I couldn't believe I was reading this. And it was actually someone who was pardoned. It was just so ridiculous. One thing I will add to the horrible tragedy on the Potomac. So one of the people who died in that plane crash was one of the first people I ever met in college. Her name is Elizabeth Keys. She's the same age as me. We were both freshmen at Tufts in the same year. And I knew her just like one of the first people I met on the very first day of college. And she was a really successful person, and I hadn't kept in touch with her for many years, but she, you know, it was really eerie because I woke up that day and it's like, there's Elizabeth in People magazine and all these things. And it was on her birthday. It was her 32nd birthday, and now she's dead. Trump is trying to project, again, strength by saying the most vile stuff in the wake of that. And not, I would just say, not only, you know, what everybody said I agree with, I would add the fact that people with intellectual disabilities were another huge target of that, and it's going to prevent other companies from trying to hire people with intellectual disabilities the way that was handled. Not only did it hurt that community, not only did it prejudice the investigation, but for families like that to wake up the day after that happened and see the president, every news outlet saying that's what the president had to say about your dead child or family member was insane. And it shows why that attention economy sort of mindset can be so toxic.
I'm going to say the most egregious part of that discourse was when he said, it's common sense. Mm. He is using common sense, as he did in the campaign, as a way to promote lies. It's not common sense that if it wasn't a white person, it was a person who couldn't meet standards. That is not common sense, but that is what he's pushing. I read just before we started recording that Lara Trump is now a Fox News host, and the whatever her show is called, the subline is, you know, bringing common sense back to news analysis, something like that. This theme that if they say it, it's common sense, is insidious, because people who are not critical thinkers, who did not have the best education background or complete education, will not see the difference. If I tell you it's common sense, you're inclined to agree because you know what common sense means, even if you don't know what the thing I'm talking about is. It's dangerous, and language is what they're controlling. I think the most upsetting visual I've seen all week is the picture of the FBI headquarters in Quantico, where they're painting over the wall in the lobby that has all these words, compassion, integrity, diversity is in the middle. And I presume that's why they're painting over the whole thing. We don't know what the new FBI will stand for, but we know they're firing on a loyalty test. And I did put this in my Trib op-ed today, too. The loyalty test is, first, they are asking employees, and I presume FBI and CIA, there's a new list that the CIA has admitted they've given the list of officers on probation so that they're easier to fire. They turned over the names and contact info on those people to DOGE today. They're being asked two questions. One, who did you vote for? And two, what was your moment of MAGA revelation?
I saw that one.
And if you don't have a good answer to those two, you're out. This is the old spoils system that used to be how we hired people in the federal government, is illegal now. Congress needs to stand up for the law.
Where are the congressmen and women? So, again, we're going to talk to – I know we're recording this on a Wednesday. On Friday, I'm going to talk to Darren LaHood, the Republican Central Illinois congressman. And I don't know what he's going to say about all of this. I'm glad he's coming on. But no Republican voices have surfaced lately to push back even a little bit, even on just some of the rhetoric. There's this expression that seems to have a little currency these days called sane washing, where you take something that's crazy and then you try and paint it in a different light. And in Eric's Picayune Sentinel, he put what J.D. Vance said about what happened on the Potomac. The president made very clear that he wasn't blaming anybody, but he was being very explicit about the fact that DEI policies have led our air traffic controllers to be short-staffed. You know, the first part of that is a lot to swallow. The president made very clear that he wasn't blaming anybody. Vance went on to say, this is a scandal. Thankfully, it's a scandal that the president has stopped. Let's just say the person at the controls did not have enough staffing around him or her because we were turning people away because of DEI reasons. Regardless of the truthfulness of that, that's a little better wash of what the president said.
But it's false. It's false. First of all, there were two people in that control tower, and one of them was, or two people who were going to be responsible for that, and one of them was sent home early. He asked to go home early, and they let him go home early. So it wasn't that they didn't have the people there. They let him go. First of all, the FAA has said that there's no truth to the idea that DEI initiatives have made it difficult for them to hire people. As I said, it makes it, in some ways, DEI makes it easier to find people because they're broadening the net, looking for more qualified people. And DEI is really about, and I know it's been getting, I think it's going to be getting an unfair rap, but it is about trying to look to broaden who you're looking for when you're filling positions and not look just at people who are like you. And that's what DEI means. And it's become a almost a slur.
Is it really that, Eric? Is it just that? I mean, doesn't DEI include or encompass giving an opportunity to people who might have otherwise been looked over because of their race or other issues that are protected?
Generally, it's about finding people who are qualified, who are members of groups that have been historically marginalized.
So members of the fire department don't sometimes get promoted ahead of white people who had better scores on tests, for instance?
That might be the case. Maybe not better scores, but certainly equal scores. There are different ways of weighing somebody's merit too. I'm not saying that. I mean, maybe they'll find out. Let's say they find out that the person whose fault this is was a person who was hired because of what group they belonged to, and they weren't that qualified, and they failed their tests or whatever. Even that doesn't justify what Trump said, because what Trump said was prejudiced, bigoted, on its face.
This is the same thing that Hegseth said, right? That we can't lower our standards in order to put women in the military. No one's lowering the standards. He said that directly to Tammy Duckworth, for God's sake. There's no indication that hiring a more diverse workforce is lowering your standards. It is, in fact, reflecting the population you serve. I feel like this is one of many ways that we make up for the decades in which the opposite happened. People were given promotions because they looked like the person who was hiring.
But isn't there value in having, say, a police force or a fire force that reflects the community they're serving, particularly the police force? And if only white people are applying or have the best scores for historic reasons, maybe, but legitimately so at that moment, then what are you going to do about that? You're going to keep hiring the white guys and make them the police officers in black communities? Or are you going to make sure that the value of that isn't just the test scores, but truly the racial composition? That's DEI. That is what Pete Hegseth would say is equal but not equitable. And so I hear what you guys are saying, and I don't disagree with everything you're saying, but I don't think you're giving a fair review of where all of these policies came from.
Well, look at how deep it goes. If people of color are not getting, or women are not getting the test scores that qualify them for these jobs, maybe it's because all of our schools on the South Side are inferior to schools on, many of them, inferior to schools on the North Side.
I get that.
So let's get rid of the education department because we don't want to provide grants.
Brandon, you're sitting there patiently listening to all of this, and I know you've got a few things to say.
I have never in my life
known any person of color who was in a high position and thought to myself, and they're not that qualified. They just got there because of their race. If anything, it is the opposite. You have lots of white people. This is the way it's been, who are hired off of their race. That's what's been happening. Hired off of being white. Mediocre, don't have the skills, don't have the qualifications. They elevate based off all these other factors. And that is what we see. I don't know any black person that gets moved ahead who's not qualified for a position. I think that's a fantasy. I really do. I think that's a made up fantasy with no substantial data to back it up. You can find the data. You can find examples right now in the Trump administration of people promoted without qualifications over their predecessor with a large laundry list of things that are make them way more qualified for the position than what they're currently holding. I think the whole idea of DEI being a way to promote people to a position they don't deserve or to not work for, I don't think that exists. I don't think that's a thing that's actually happened. I think that's a fantasy from people who have a white grievance mentality and feel like white people are being pushed away or pushed to the side. No. You look at corporate America, you look at most of these positions and jobs, it's still majority dominated by white men. Nothing's changed really except opening up the playing field more and getting more people opportunity to be able to be involved in it. That's all. They still gotta pass the tests. They still gotta have a resume. They can't just like, hey, black guy off the street. You're a city council member.
No, but I do think that
a black guy who's a television pretty boy, you can run the Department of Defense. Boom. To have Pete Hegseth be the one to denigrate women in combat, people of color in combat, when he is the most underqualified person to ever run the Department of Defense, is more than insulting. I don't have a word more than insulting, but if I had it, I would insert it now.
I have to counter what Brandon said by mentioning one of the most prominent opponents of affirmative action, Clarence Thomas.
Case in point.
Boy, really, yeah. As Kendrick says, they not like us.
Who was the 999 guy who ran the Department of Housing?
Herman Cain.
Yes. So Trump is good at picking underqualified people of color and white people underqualified as well to put into jobs. So qualifications for him, I don't know what that means. And it's so insulting for him to try to set standards for people of color. And then he allows DOGE to just wholesale hatchet people who they don't even know their qualifications because
well,
they didn't bother to check.
I don't know why I'm arguing this point, and I don't know that I am. But it does seem that where there is a measure of subjectivity to a hire, be it the firefighter or a Supreme Court justice, where there is a measure of subjectivity to the thing, we have tried to, via DEI or whatever umbrella you want to put it on, give a step up to people of color or women or minorities or people who weren't previously granted access. And if that means that you've hopscotched over somebody else who maybe has some other qualifications that are superior, that will be the price we pay to give more opportunity to this broader base of people that Eric and all of you are talking about. I don't know that I agree with you, Brandon, that that thing I'm talking about is a fantasy. I think that does happen.
I really don't. The mantra in the black community is you have to work twice as hard.
I understand that. I understand.
Of what white people get. And this is still the case. I just don't think you have black people, brown people, Asian people, anybody who's in a position right now who is a person of color from a marginalized community in a high ranking position who is there strictly off of their race. They're not just, they have the qualifications, they have the expertise. What I can say is you have a bunch of people who are white people who don't meet the qualifications, who are in there because of other things. Pete Hegseth and others in the Trump cabinet. I can't think of one black person out there who's not qualified. And I think of it this way, in sports terms. We just, in college football, had a college football playoff where they expanded things to 12 teams. In the past, a committee decided who the four best teams were, and it was always Alabama, Clemson, Georgia, and then you throw in an Ohio State. Now that there's more teams involved, more chances for access, you had a team like SMU get in there. You had a team like Boise State get in there. And you got more people involved. They earned their way in. They didn't just get thrown in. And it led to a better product. I think that is what DEI is all about. Not
giving someone an unearned opportunity over somebody else. And I think the reason why there's so much pushback against this narrative of DEI doing that is because nobody can point to an example of any person from a marginalized community who is in a position they have not earned. No one can point to it. We can point to the opposite, but I can't find one.
Clarence Thomas was elevated.
I would argue Clarence has earned it. He was a lawyer. He was a legal scholar. He earned his right. He made some mistakes, but he earned it. I can't deny
some mistakes.
George Bush Sr. said he was the most qualified person in the country to be a Supreme Court justice at the time, and he had very little legal experience. I disagree with his politics, but I can't say that he was chosen purely on merit.
And I'm arguing that, you know, what is quote unquote merit? And maybe your personal story, your background, the color of your skin is meritus. That's part of the skill set, the background that you bring to, say, being a Supreme Court justice. Like, who would be the best pick for Supreme Court justice? That's impossible to determine. But maybe does it help to have a Latina or a black person sitting on that panel? Yes. So I don't mind that Clarence Thomas gained some favor because we thought we needed a more blended Supreme Court. Just turned out he was a liar and other bad things.
I have one other point to bring up. I thought you were going here, Brandon. You are correct that there are innumerable white men in positions for which they are underqualified. But the one thing that I think really feeds this misunderstanding of DEI is the countless number of white men who think they were better qualified than a black person who got the job, but may not have been. A lot of aggrieved people, if they don't get the job, they're like, well, they hired so-and-so instead because they needed more women or they needed more black, Latino, whatever. And so I was the best qualified, but because I'm white, I didn't get it. That's a grievance in your own head that may not, and I would argue most of the time, probably not, actually based in fact. And in fact, people who complain that way are shortchanging the best interests of the company itself, in my opinion. But that's what feeds it, right? It's the people who didn't get the job, and they're going to make a racist or sexist claim to justify the fact that they didn't get it.
Austin, yep. Before I move on, do you want to say anything you'll regret, or should we just move on?
The thing, this issue makes my head just spin like a million miles an hour. The quote that I always come back to that makes this issue so difficult to untangle with where we're at in America today is the person who 2018, 19, it was like, if you didn't read this book, like you were totally out of the loop on everything, was Ibram X. Kendi. And Ibram X. Kendi has this line, and I think it all comes down to this, where he says the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. And at the end of the day, we're going to be circling around the idea of what level of discrimination, and I mean that in the technical sense, to what extent do we weight someone's race in terms of decisions that we make about the workplace or building a team or whatever? And there are completely legitimate reasons to prioritize someone of a given race for a position. Like you said, John, that actually is part of merit, depending on what the position is. I don't think we have evolved enough brains as humans to get past this or something, because it's at a certain point you're talking about when are you free to discriminate in a technical term based on race, and when should you not be? And that it all comes down to that. And I feel like it's almost always sort of a case by case thing.
Don't you think the timeline gets lost too? In my lifetime, I went to swimming pools that blacks could not swim in. And for us to say in this very short span of time, therefore, now everything is the same and there's no reason for a DEI initiative, for instance, I think is asking society to evolve a lot more quickly than it can or has. There aren't even vestiges of racism. The racism is still there. There still is discrimination. Thanks, John. We didn't know that.
This is a intentional issue Trump is putting out there, a wedge issue that seeks to divide people. So I just encourage folks to not let it. Diversity is our strength. equity is our strength. If that makes me partisan for thinking so, it really shouldn't be a partisan thing to say. We should all want diversity in thought and religion and culture. That's what America is about. And I think that that's something we should continue to celebrate.
The Rascals continue after this quick message from our sponsor, Ottawa, Illinois. If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa. It's a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique stores, small town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer. I'll attest to that. And all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Settle down, snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, hotels, private rentals, cottages, B&Bs. Start making memories in Ottawa, the middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. A controversial piece of art at the Chicago Cultural Center is still up. We've talked about this before. In fact, at the same time that Benjamin Netanyahu was standing next to Donald Trump, a protest puppet of Netanyahu and Uncle Sam remain on display in Chicago. The blood is on their hands, and the city council largely favors removing that art. The head of the city's Department of Cultural Affairs says the art will stay. And the four-hour debate about this on the council floor included Alderman Byron Sigcho-Lopez using the words, "This is white supremacist." Was he talking about Alderman Bill Conway or the art in general? It's hard to say, but the art's still there in a publicly supported place. And I think the fact that it is a public place, tax dollars, I think is not a small issue here.
So Conway's my alderman, so I pay close attention to what he does and generally been much happier with him than I thought I would be, actually. I think he's doing a great job in a lot of ways. So, but this is what sparked Sigcho-Lopez's anger. The person on the stand was the current commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, a black woman. And Conway was questioning her about the art. He was offended by what he considered the message of the art. And he asked her, "Do you support the message behind this piece of art?" And from the paper, it was unclear, but it felt to Sigcho-Lopez like he was berating her and pressuring her. And he intercepted to rescue the black woman, who I would argue could have defended herself, probably. She's a, anyway, that there were a whole lot of dynamics in there. I would take a step back and say the question was out of line, not because he was asking this of a black woman, but because the whole premise of art is to not, it's out there for us all to interpret. It impacts you the way it does. If this is how you interpret it, that's what you get out of it, that's great. If it's what I get out of it, that's for me to get out of it. Years ago for NPR, I interviewed Martin Puryear, the sculptor Martin Puryear, and he didn't like to do interviews, and I probably personified why, because he didn't like to talk about his art, basically. But he let me in a studio, we walked around, and I would go to these pieces and tell me, you know, what's behind this? Why did you create this? And after tolerating me for a couple minutes, he turned to me frustrated and said, "Marge, if I could describe my art, I'd be a writer." He was a sculptor. And that's the whole point about art. Remember Mayor Rizzo of Philadelphia for some art controversy in the 70s? He wanted to remove a piece of public art and he said, "I know art and that's not art." Well, not for you to say what's art. I don't think it's, I think the fact that we have public displays of art for people to interpret is a strength for our city. Do you know Chicago was the first major city in the country, maybe one of the first in the world, to have public art? The Picasso piece in Daley Plaza. There wasn't public art of major artists until we did that. And then after that, everybody wanted art in their cities, and all the major artists wanted to build art in our city because we respected the voice of the artist. And that's the fundamental issue here, in my opinion. And I think Conway was out of line for that reason.
He was comparing it to flag burning, I think, in one of in part of his remarks. And I'm pleased with Mayor Johnson's response, which is he is not going along with his call to remove that art. I can see maybe a directive or an attempt made by someone who is curating an exhibit like that to have balanced points of view to have another piece of art, but I really don't like the idea of taking down a piece of art because some people don't like its message. I think that that is it's un-American. It doesn't actually violate the First Amendment, I don't think, but it does strike me as
But chilling. Not hosting it doesn't violate the First Amendment either. Nobody's saying you can't make your art. The question is, do you want to, have to, or need to host it or amend it for that matter?
Right, right. I don't think that you do. I think that the people who are putting together the exhibit might want to think about, how do we balance this out? If we're, you know, what is the purpose of this exhibit? What are we trying to show here? Are we trying to show here's a pro-Hamas sculpture, if that's not too strong a term? Do we have something that's maybe more pro-Israel that talks about the October 7th massacre and explains it? I don't know, but it does. I can see why people are angry about it, but I also think that taking it down would just be chilling in a way that we don't want to be.
All right, so here's Alderperson Deborah Silverstein, the council's only Jewish member. She said, it's not just an art exhibit. It's a statement made in a publicly funded, city-run space, a space intended to welcome tours and represent the values of Chicago. Let me be very clear, this is not a First Amendment issue. I bristle a little bit at the values of Chicago. That sounds like something somebody says when they're running for mayor or they want to be the coach of the football team, but I'm not exactly sure what that encompasses. But I do take her point that it is a publicly funded piece of art. So maybe the city council's opinion on this does matter. I kind of respect the cultural affairs head who stood up to them, and I'm surprised she has that much authority. I don't know who decides what goes there or not. Evidently, she can. And now I really want to go see that thing. I haven't gone over there yet.
I haven't seen it yet. I'd like to. I think it's be interesting to see. Even if I disagree with it, I think that's what art's about. I think, as Marge eloquated pretty well there, Cook County is home to the largest population of Palestinian Americans in the country. And so when we talk about the city and what it represents, are local Palestinians not entitled to have expression of their views about a painful part of their history and a painful thing that's happening to their community right now? Can they not perform their experiences, do art about their experiences? Can they not punch up at power as the rest of us are able to do with our own political or commentary statements? Like, I think this is a First Amendment issue. I think it's a gross overreach by these aldermen. Some of these 27 aldermen, coincidentally, also were part of the group that said, why are we doing a ceasefire resolution? This has nothing to do with us. Well, now they feel like it has everything to do with them. And I find that really hypocritical. Yeah. I can understand why people might be offended. And I've stepped back about this and thought, what if this is something that was sensitive to my community? How would I feel? Ultimately, it is free speech. Ultimately, I don't think it's saying anything targeting a culture. It's targeting a government. It's making a political statement. And that's what art does. It's expression. And we should be, as a city, open to allowing people to freely express themselves.
I want the record to show that one of you on the panel here today did say something good about Mayor Brandon Johnson. Maybe we should mark the tape, send out a press release. Somebody said, I agree with Brandon Johnson about something.
That was me, John, and I deny saying it.
You're going to sane wash that now? And what I meant by that was? Okay, so... Brandon, you all contracted with another firm to do, or Austin, you guys contracted with another firm to do a survey on CPS, CTU, the mayor, et cetera. Can you just walk us through a couple of those findings?
Yeah, sure. I will say something good about Brandon Johnson, by the way, which I haven't seen anyone give him credit for. In the last, call it 3 to 6 months, after a first year and a half of really not speaking to media a lot, or doing it under kind of odd circumstances, this guy is speaking to media at a pretty impressive pace. He's doing long press conferences. He's taking wild questions. People might not like his answers, but he is, you cannot say this guy is not publicly talking about what he believes and thinks in, both in press conferences. He did the WTTW forum thing on Monday. He's out there a lot. Bad news, yeah, people don't really love what he's saying or do it. So the poll found that he currently has, 80% of Chicagoans have an unfavorable opinion of Brandon Johnson compared to 14% who have a favorable opinion. That is definitely the worst on record for any sitting mayor in modern Chicago history. I don't know if that's too huge of a surprise to people. That's in line with other polling that's come out recently. But the most interesting part of that poll to me was that for the first time that I've seen, people, voters in the city of Chicago, across demographic groups, across political lines, are disaggregating the schools and the teachers union. People love their schools and love their teachers. They do not love the political machine of the Chicago Teachers Union. And those are two separate things. Those used to be very much combined. I think for some people, they still are. But you see, for the schools, it's about 50-50, favorable, unfavorable on Chicago public schools. With the Chicago Teachers Union, it's 60-30. So it's 2-1 opposed. People have an unfavorable view of the Chicago Teachers Union. And their president, Stacey Davis Gates, is similarly disliked, although not as many people know her name. So that was what was most interesting to me, especially as, and we're, this is like playing out even today. The union is going to vote on the fact-finding report from a neutral arbiter. They reject the fact-finding report. That starts the clock. It's, they have to cool down for 30 days, and then after that, they can vote to strike. And I think what many people see, the union and outside observers see polls like this and say, it's going to be very difficult for them to strike if, because the public is not really on the side of the Chicago Teachers Union right now.
Austin, has your organization polled the favorability of the teachers union previously? Can you compare? This is our
Yes, we have. So if you go, Illinois Policy right now actually has our quarterly tracking poll on them. And you can see that they're the worst unfavorable numbers that we have on our tracking. And then I will say, even previously, if you talk to folks in the Emanuel administration, for example, some of you may remember, obviously, the Laquan McDonald tragedy was one reason that Rahm Emanuel did not run for re-election. Another reason was that Karen Lewis was among the most popular political figures in the city, the president of the CTU at that time. At the CTU at that time, and in most previous administrations, you saw 60 to 70% approval. 60 to 70% of Chicagoans approved the Chicago Teachers Union. That's completely upside down now. That's what's really changed. So over time, this is something we have not, looking back, we have not seen something like this in the last, at least, I would say, 20 years for the CTU.
Knowing how you feel about Stacey Davis Gates and the Chicago Teachers Union, I can't say I was surprised by the results. And I don't mean that the way it just sounded, because I think they sound right. But I also wonder if I should question the source of the funding of a survey that aligns itself with the person that asked for the survey.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, people can, we posted the crosstabs and the top lines on our website. People can check out the weights. I mean, I think it's like 11% of respondents voted for Trump. 80+% were, you know, liberal or moderate voters. So it's reflecting the electorate. I will also say M3 was the most accurate pollster in the 2023 mayoral election. They called the first round and second round almost exactly. That's why we picked them. So it's not just our name. I mean, they're a pollster. They trade on their name. So if they're putting out bad numbers, and I encourage anyone else, run your own survey, run your own poll.
Yeah, and spend your own money.
I have a lot of confidence in this one.
Do you think that Brandon Johnson asking for higher property taxes on million-dollar properties is going to help his numbers?
Well, specifically, he said, and he said this Monday, and then he was asked about it in the press conference, it was specifically around Bring Chicago Home, yeah, which was the thing we all voted on, would have tripled the real estate transfer tax on sales of properties over $1 million, commercial or residential, in the city of Chicago. And he often brings that up as sort of saying, hey, look, I tried for progressive revenue and the people of the city of Chicago voted against it. In fact, he doesn't say the people of the city of Chicago voted against it. He says, like, evil billionaires and corporations tricked people into voting no. Here's the problem. Brandon Johnson's record in governance and popularity right now means that if he attaches his name to a citywide referendum like that, it will not pass because he's supporting it. So I think it's not really a helpful way forward yeah, in terms of talking about solutions for the city.
I'm interested in that. Is he proposing to do another referendum? Because
he's falling short of specifically saying that. He's just saying, you know, when we try again, he'll have like a sort of a broad statement, like when we try again on this. And then when pressed on it, he said, They're saying, well, does that mean you're going to try to get it on the ballot again? And he goes, well, no, that would be a conversation with all the different stakeholders, right? So he's falling short of saying, we're putting this on the ballot again.
I talked to a lot of people before that Bring Chicago Home referendum, and my memory is that it wasn't so much that people wanted mansion owners not to pay a higher transfer tax, but they realized that this kind of evaluation of property was going to hit a lot of three flats, six flats, businesses,
right,
people who are not the ultra wealthy, and if you had perhaps crafted the referendum to talk about, say, single family homes that sell for more than $1 million, of course you would have brought in much less money, but you would have been able really to successfully make the case that this is really attaching to wealthy people rather than just middle class people who happen to own, like, say, a three flat. And I think that's why that referendum failed, which was that it didn't actively persuade people that it was going to be just getting wealthy people, but it was going to get middle class people as well. So if they could refine the referendum in that way, I think it would pass. I think there is a fairly large constituency for that kind of progressive revenue, but it was not, they did not successfully rebut the argument that it wasn't particularly progressive.
It wouldn't affect 92% of the home owners, or only 8% of the buildings sell for $1 million or more, or I guess are valued at $1 million or more. Saw that statistic. I'm recalling it off the top of my head. If I'm wrong, I'm not wrong by much, although that does sound low to me. But wasn't part of the problem, too, that people didn't trust the administration to do with the money what they said they were going to do?
That's right. I was going to interject that. You're right, John. That was an aspect of it, too, that he needed more clarity about how the money would be used. And also, to your point, Eric, there was a lot of pushback from lower income communities of color, where people who were moving into the middle class were able to help redevelop vacant properties. They would buy a two flat or a three flat, rehab it, and up the value of it. And they felt that this would discourage development in those communities that Johnson wants to rebuild and reinvest in. So it was too broad a brush, to your point, I think, Eric, trying to capture as much money without being specific or not understanding the specifics. And then to John's point, where are you going to put all that money?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to help housing. It was too vague.
Marge, talk just a little bit about the Bear Stadium, the Michael Reese site, and what the mayor said about that this week.
So Johnson, on Tuesday, spoke in favor of a museum campus infrastructure plan that had many of the elements that he agreed to provide to the Bears if they get their lakefront stadium. And immediately there was some outcry about, why are you feeding into the Bears lakefront stadium plan that is virtually dead and that there's not support for in Springfield? And he said, well, we have to do this anyway. It's just good infrastructure. It'll help the existing museums. I don't know what makes downtown development of any kind a priority for a mayor who wants to invest in neighborhoods, and as we just discussed, continually fails to garner the funds for it. Now he wants, I forget, a half a billion, 600 million, something like that, to put into the lakefront museum campus. I can see it out my window. I live right here, and yeah, there's some traffic problems, but even on Bears Day, it doesn't totally gridlock this neighborhood. It just is a poor use of money. Then he was asked, well, what about the Michael Reese site, which the Bears have indicated they are now taking a serious look at? He said, well, they haven't brought me a proposal, so it's really nothing until they come to me with it. He, you know, again, I love, as a communications person, I'd like to put words in his mouth. And what I wish he had said was, I know the Bears are looking at that, and there seems to be some real potential, and I'll be very interested to see what comes together there so that we can evaluate our options fairly on behalf of the taxpayers. This infrastructure plan is a clear handout to me. It's a clear handout to the Bears, and it's a way to keep their lakefront proposal alive. That, to me, is not in the best interest of our city.
The mayor saying we would continue to put money in the museum campus area, adjacent to which would be a new Bears stadium, is just a carrot to keep the Bears interested in developing the lakefront. But if the Bears decide they're going to go to Arlington Heights or someplace else, what's the point of putting all of that money into the museum campus area? That's not a rhetorical question. Do we need $600 million worth of improvements over there? And Is that a priority over everything else?
He talked largely about traffic patterns. And as I said, I see it out my window. I walk around the neighborhood on Bears Day. Yes, there's a lot of traffic, but it's not gridlock. I don't think there's a big concern. And certainly Free Day Tuesday doesn't lock up the South Loop. You know, I don't know what he's addressing. And, you know, to Austin's repeated point, where's the big picture long-range plan that includes this? It's in the Bears plan, but I don't think these are details that have been put on a front burner for the city.
You've been arguing the last month or two that helping the Bears out is either a conflict or just a bad idea for the mayor. And I think helping the Bears stay in Chicago is not outside the mayor's purview. That's something that it's Chicago's team.
That's why his comments about the Michael Reese site were so upsetting. I think the Bears belong in the Michael Reese site. That's an underdeveloped area.
You're not mayor, Marge. I mean, what if people want? What if people do want it over by the museum campus?
Well, we haven't seen an outpouring of support for that.
Brandon, where do you think it's going to go? Where would you put it if you could?
You know, ultimately, I mean, if I could, I love the idea of a lakefront stadium. I think the idea of it's great. Just the all the stuff in between, it gets messy, right?
Does anyone propose putting it in the lake?
Structure in the middle. We all take a boat to it.
I think Austin is somewhat serious. Well, there was a proposal to put an airport in the lake at one point. A man-made island out there.
Look what they're doing in Dubai and places like that. They have whole
exactly. I was thinking of that Dubai island thing that's like shaped like a palm tree.
Yeah,
exactly
yeah.
like that.
You mean the shape of a football.
We know for sure is that the Bears want to be on the lakefront. Now, we know the Mayor Johnson wants them on the lakefront.
Why would you want a dome stadium on the lakefront? There's no view of the lake from inside the dome. And if you have is it because the blimp will get a view of the stadium and the skyline?
It's the lucrativeness of being able to host Super Bowls, of Olympics, of major events. It's the marketability. It's the aerial shots that they take when they do the games. That's what they're going for, honestly.
Aerial shots, I'll give you, but the Michael Reese site would give you the same ability to host events, and actually a site on the west side, a dome stadium on the west side where there's more real estate for parking and so on, would give you that.
Now, I don't think Arlington Heights is a bad idea. I have no issue going to Arlington Heights for a game. I think that most NFL teams are not located in the city they're actually proclaimed to be in. So
that's true. And I have the same thing for me and for probably most, I mean, for the vast majority of us who are Bears fans, it's a TV show and we don't really care where the studio
is. Totally
agree.
Well, that's why I want it on the lake, because I think the TV show would look good from the lake and I don't have to hide the traffic anyway.
But for Johnson's legacy, it does. If 10 years from now, 20 years from now, he can say I was the person who kept the Bears in Chicago. I mean, that does sound good. You know,
couldn't he say I did that by reinvesting in the communities that needed it most and putting it on the Michael Reese site? There's a lovely lakefront skyline blimp view from there.
How you do it matters. I think we can all agree, though. I was making my face at Mars because I've been to quite a few Soldier Field events. It's a nightmare. Try to get out of there, especially a Beyonce concert. Oh, God.
You don't take the train? What's the matter with
I
you?
I do, but still.
Even
just,
if you do.
Try to get out and get to it. It's just...
I had a friend, I will say, last year, do you guys remember, there's this Messi with Miami FC was coming.
Yeah.
I had a friend, last minute, I was like, hey, get down here. And he lives in, he was in a place where he couldn't get on a train. He's texting me halfway through the game. This is an hour and a half through the game. He goes, I've been in the loop for an hour and a half and I have not moved an inch. I can't go. I'm sorry. It gets really crazy.
Well, but of course, Messi didn't play, right?
He didn't.
No, he didn't. But there was a mob around the hotel where I was walking downtown that night for something else. And there was a mob. They were blocking off by the Blackstone where he was supposed to be staying. He might have been here. I don't remember whether he was here or not, but he didn't play. And the police had blocked off a lot of streets because of the traffic. But that's why we have mass transit, which we should be investing more in.
I think most Bears fans would agree they would like to see a more NFL tailgate friendly and visitor-friendly area around any NFL stadium that the Bears are going to have. Arlington Heights provides that. Michael Reese might provide that, right? But that's ultimately the goal. If you go to Indianapolis, Cincinnati, any of our nearby Midwest cities, they all have a really great ecosystem of just park your car, pull up, tailgate, have a great time. You can't really do that in Chicago, which is like, of all the sports cities, probably the biggest football city you can find. It's baffling that that's not the case here. And that definitely needs to change for marketability, for lucratability, for the brand itself of the Chicago Bears, and for the city. You got to build that ecosystem for sure.
One last question. Speaking of stadiums, I want to ask you guys what you think is going to happen at the United Center tonight. We're recording this Wednesday afternoon. We'll know Wednesday evening, so I know this will be dated, but we'll be on record for guessing what the reaction will be from Chicago Blackhawks fans. Here, let me read from Paul Sullivan. It wasn't a big surprise to hear Nashville Predators fans booing the Canadian national anthem Monday night at Bridgestone Arena. The Predators were playing the Ottawa Senators, whose fans booed our national anthem before a game last week. It quickly became a trend in NHL arenas across Canada and at a Toronto Raptors NBA home game. So it was probably a matter of time before reciprocal booing became a thing at U.S. venues. Sullivan says it doesn't seem to matter that the booing is over proposed tariffs on Canada and Mexico that the Wall Street Journal called the dumbest trade war in history. The Tennesseans felt they needed to stick up for their country, right or wrong. And now it is Chicago's turn. So tonight, Wednesday evening, the Edmonton Oilers will come to town for a game against the Blackhawks at the United Center. We'll see if fans from our mostly blue city will act like lemmings and boo the Canadian anthem just because some Canadians booed ours. Hopefully not, he writes. What do you guess our microphones will broadcast the game tonight on WGN Radio, including the pregame anthems. So what do you think the fans in Chicago, which he describes as in a blue city, what do you think the fans at the hockey game are going to do?
I will vote for a mixed reaction. I'm going to say there's going to be boos, but there are also going to be some cheers from people who are realizing what's actually going on here. And I'll also add that I think this whole business of booing national anthems is really unfortunate, especially given that Canada is one of our closest allies and biggest trading partners.
By the way, Eric, you have long said you don't understand why we have the national anthem before sporting events anyway. You have an ally in Paul Sullivan who writes, I'm not sure why the anthem has to be played before a game. We don't listen to the anthem at a movie theater and other places, so what are we doing here? But it's there, and if you take it away, that will be a statement unto itself. So good luck to you on that.
I'd lean mix, but if I got to pick one or the other, they're not going to boo. It'd be a shame if they boo, because the Canada National Anthem is beautiful. I think it's a beautiful song.
Depends. Also, what's the John Hansen involvement in? Is he
is he going to rev up the crowd?
Yeah.
If he
implores, he's very persuasive. He should implore people to just be respectful. Actually, if he does that, I would guess that they do
exactly.
Boo. If people are told
exactly.
Not to boo, that will ensure that.
That was our conversation, and I was going to send him a text because John Hansen, who works at WGN Radio, and when he can be a member of our panel here, he's the in-game announcer. He does all of the fun stuff at the games, and I thought if they say, everyone, please rise for the national anthem of the Canadian people, blah, blah, blah. If they say, and please, let's show respect for our good neighbors to the north, you've just invited the boo birds.
Yeah. I would hope we get a mixed response. I think that's the most optimistic thing. I'll bring up something that I've heard Rich Daly say many times. As much as he was a Sox fan, for example, you probably know that he rarely attended the games. And the reason he would say is because they're going to boo because they're all drunks.
and I know, and they could be half a beer into the, you know, even the, because the pregame stuff for a Blackhawks game is sometimes better than the game. So I can imagine the crowd, just for the fun of it, for the pro-Americanism of it, would start to boo without even thinking what they're saying. Connor Bedard, our best player, the future of the Blackhawks, is Canadian. Think about that when you're raining some boos down on the ice on that kid. We've gone long, guys, so I'm not even going to ask you to do a red light, green light, yellow light, things you're recommending or passing on, but we'll get to that next week. Marge Halperin, Austin Berg, Brandon Pope, and Eric Zorn. Thanks for being part of the panel this week. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Good conversation.
See ya.
Okay,
I'm
going to
go play the Canada National Anthem. It really is.
Yeah.
That's right. It is a good song. It is.
It really is. It's catchy.
Did you guys ever play bubble hockey? You could change the anthem that you do.
No.
When I was a kid, we played bubble hockey. You could change it to Canada.
Oh, yeah. Man. All right, y'all.
Peace.
See you later.
Take care.
All right. Bye, y'all.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.